Hi, and welcome to the Politics of Justice. It's me, Amy Austin. So let me start off this recording with a trigger warning. I should say that there's going to be discussion of molestation in these chapters. Unfortunately, it's something that I encountered when I was working as a guardian or representing parents whose children were in foster care. And I wanted to include that realistic depiction in this book. But it's a hard topic. It's a hard topic. And I just wanted to put the warning up front. I'll be sure to put it in the show notes as well. So when I left off, it was chapter 29, and now I'm at chapter 30, which is called Daddy's Little Girl. So, as we talked about earlier, Olivia's parents divorced, and Sheila's really trying to carry the burden of single parenting and a new career and her addiction problems. It's a lot. But Keith exists. So let's go to the first note in chapter 30. It says, and this is from Keith's perspective. Before I followed her to Michigan for 3 years, my mother warned me that giving in to this kind of whim would be the end of my marriage, and I might have listened to my mother if I'd had time to think. But law school was a roller coaster that never stopped. During the year, we were always going to one mixer or another. Her summer jobs, nothing like ice cream skipping we'd done in high school, were all consuming. I dropped out of her social life halfway through law school. There's nothing worse than going to all those lunches, dinners, and parties at the big houses on Fairmont or North Park Boulevard. Her colleagues and I were as different as night and day. The attorneys she worked for were all white men with wives who didn't work. Brad or Chet or Chip were always shaking my hand and asking me what I did for a living. Was I a golf man? Did I belong to the skating club? When I said that I worked for RTA, they started asking me about the big bosses. When I didn't know them, or when they looked at my hands and realized I didn't work in upper offices, they wrote me off and didn't take glasses to see that I didn't fit into her world. So I'm sure that the note there is that is one of my favorite lines. It didn't take glasses to see that I didn't fit into her world. So I remember this world from back in the day, and there are a lot of white men partners at these big law firms. Their wives generally didn't work. And the skating club, I'd forgotten about that. It was a, what is the word I want? It was at the time, I don't even, this is so vague, but it was an exclusive club in Shaker that people belonged to. I assume it was ice skating. It's so vague. It was so long ago. But there are similar clubs in Los Angeles, smaller clubs that are fairly exclusive that people belong to centered around an activity. I'll just say that. I've been to some of them. They are what they are. There are many, many ways that people sort themselves and exclude others. And it was no different in Cleveland. So, in this chapter, Keith is sitting, I think, sitting in his apartment, and the phone is ringing. So, with each, this is the next highlight, with each ring, my heart sped up. Then I stopped with each pause. After six rings, the answering machine picked up. I hung on Sheila's voice. Not home, I said guilty, that I felt nothing but relief. She's at that age, probably with some friends. Try again tomorrow. I nodded and walked back to my chair. I'd give it a couple of weeks, work up my courage. What if my daughter hated me, wanted nothing to do with me? That rejection would be nothing but my own damned fault. I guess he's working up the courage to call her. And actually, I'm thinking about this. So Oprah recently did a fairly controversial podcast, which she filmed in like a little studio similar to how she used to do the show, talking about estranged parents. And one of the parents that people found the most sympathetic, I guess I'd say, was a father who his daughter hadn't spoken to him, and when she called him because she needed something, and he stepped up and got to therapy and changed his relationship with his daughter. But I think that it's interesting that fathers get estranged for two reasons. Mothers are a whole different ball of wax. One, because the child has pulled away, and the other, because the father has pulled away. And I've often wondered what that's like. I once read a book about fatherless daughters, and it talked about life from a child's perspective, but I've always wondered what absentee fathers would say. And actually, until that Oprah thing, I hadn't had like sort of a clue, and he wasn't an absentee father in that way, but I hadn't had like a clue into what fathers think. Because if you, my experience is that if you talk to absentee fathers, they have a lot of excuses as to why they're absentee fathers, generally based on their feelings about the mother. But I have not met an absentee father who sort of takes responsibility for stepping out. But when I was practicing in Ohio, I noticed that often when men were done with the women, they were done with the children as well. And it's a shame, but it is what it is. So we moved on to chapter 31, which is called Behind Closed Doors. So, as we know, Olivia's in foster care with this kid named Jermaine, who is slightly older than her. And his behavior is both immature and inappropriate. So the highlight is this is Olivia's chapter 31. My body jolted like someone was walking across my grave. The small strawberry shortcake nightlight flickered on, bathing the room in an odd pinkish yellow glow. I'd forgotten to lock the door like I'd been told. What was there to fear? My mother had long ago told me that monsters weren't real. And the note is that writing these chapters were some of the hardest I'd ever written. And it is because it's hard because I think the girls and women are like preyed upon. I mean, I'm reading a book now that talks about the incidents of assault and various kinds of assault upon women, and it's high and it's a lot, and the perpetrators are like heavily majority men, over 90%. And yet, even though it's common, which it's horrible that it is, it's not, I think that there's a certain, I'm finding that it's unexpected in a way. I mean, we talk about women walking with keys between their hands, but I think that there's a certain innocence that comes until it's violated. The last highlight was about she doesn't know what's coming. And so when she thinks it's going to be the foster mother, it's Jermaine who's knocking on her door. And she says that sleep and its companion, oblivion, were what I craved. And so that's sort of how she's getting through this experience. And it's a coping mechanism that many people use, often in depression as well. But it's one way to get through an awful experience because at least for 8 hours of any given day, you don't have to experience whatever's going on out there that's awful. Chapter 32 is called Shattered Glass, and it is. So it's a Casey chapter. And she is, oh, she's in her office. And she's really like thinking about getting down to work, which is pretty hard. So she's talking to one of her clients, one of her poorer clients. And she said, the client says, I'm supposed to testify. Buyers look taken aback. This is what I hated about juvenile. Everybody loved to get down and dirty when it came to talking about other people's parenting, but they didn't want to go public. It took it back. In chapter 32, Casey is talking to one of the social workers and about testifying. And she's encountering the fact that people don't want to testify. And in this case, it's one of the social workers who participated in the removal of Olivia. And it says the posted note is that most witnesses were afraid to testify in court when it came down to it. It was actually the oddest thing. Like, people like the idea of the justice system, like the idea of truth prevailing, but get terrified of being involved in the process as a witness. I'm not sure. Like, I could never quite figure out what they thought was going to happen. Were they going to thought they were going to be tripped up in a lie that they didn't want to say the thing? So people will tell you all sorts of things, and he did this and they did that and this happened to me or whatever, and you're like, okay, fine, but you're gonna have to testify that to that in court. And then silence. It's the oddest thing, and I actually don't know what people fear about the process, because if they are telling the truth and they have nothing to fear, I'm not talking about people who have the potential of jail or losing their kids or something. But just as a like a straight up witness in a case, I never understood what it was they feared. Maybe one day I'll figure that out, or not. Who knows? It's just something I didn't understand, and I think was surprising when I came to it, because people, there's so much bluster in people when they talk about the justice system. And if the judge heard what I had to say, or if the truth got out, or whatever, and you're like, okay, here's your chance for the judge, jury, whomever, and for the truth to come out, and suddenly silence. So chapter 33 is one of these sort of vestiges of me trying to write like other people, and I think I talked about that early on in these videos. And so it's called Washington Murmurs, and it's about the backroom machinations going on as they involve Sheila's nomination. I think I wanted the idea that what she was going through in juvenile court, like, how do I say this? Rumor wise, rumor mill wise, like trickled, got to Washington, D.C. somehow, and was going to affect her confirmation process. I was just, so I'm reading this book called Erased, which I don't recommend. It is so depressing. It's about like, oh, it's about like just patriarchy in America, and like how we're all like effed in the end. Every once a year, I read one of these books, and I'm just like, oh my God, the world's awful. So I don't recommend the book. But while I was reading it today, she was talking about how long the confirmation process is, and it's usually several months, and how Amy Coney Barrett, when nominated for the Supreme Court, like was confirmed in like 40 days or something, and it's like one of the swiftest confirmations ever. But in reality, the confirmation process, even like taking out the whole like obstructionist part that's really come to the fore in the last, I don't know, at this point, 20 years, maybe. Oh God, okay, maybe it's 20 years. Is a lengthy process, and usually people who are like aiming to be confirmed have to meet with people in the judiciary and their own senators if they're not on the committee, like take them down and introduce them around. And like try to, put a human face to the name and get people on board with voting. And this is just in the Senate. The advice and consent of the Senate is required for federal appointments. And so just trying to like swan around and meet the people so that they like are willing to confirm you for this lifetime position. All federal judges are lifetime appointees. So the pay is not as high as a lot of other lawyers, but it's a lifetime federal job, dodging, going after that. And actually, there's often a shortage because there's a lot of cases, and the number of judges increases slowly. I mean, obviously, the Supreme Court has increased none, but they do increase the number of federal judges, but it's very slow. There's a backup. But the process of getting appointed in many cases is highly political. So it takes a minute. And I really wanted to emphasize that it's not just like you walk in, you get nominated, you do your hearing, and you see that. So on C-SPAN, you'll see the hearings, or if they're more like controversial on like various like TV outlets. But that's just the culmination of all the meetings and glad handing and backroom dealing. And I wanted to bring that in. In later books, I don't do this anymore. I don't put in any of that background information. But it was the first book I wrote. And even if it's not the first that was published. And back then, I was not so great about what to leave out. We'll just say that. Let's just say that. I'm better now. Better now about what people want to leave out. So chapter 34 is an Olivia chapter. It's called She's Not My Mother. Basically, Olivia's like, I think the foster mom's picking up from school, and it's a new school, the third school she's at so far that year, maybe the fourth, I don't know at this point. And people are like, oh, your mom's here, and she gets this like huge feeling in her chest that this woman's not her mother. And it doesn't matter as far as these kids are concerned, but it like really matters to her that the life that she's living is foreign and it's mistaken for being normal. And she really struggles with that. So chapter 35 is called Relative Placement. So at the time I was practicing, and I assume now, but obviously I don't keep up on things that I'm not involved in, it was always preferable that children be placed with relatives over being placed in foster care. That did not like often happen initially because the placements were considered an emergency. And so therefore they were placed right away, like in emergency custody. And then sometimes they were, so the emergency placement didn't last long because as I mentioned before, it's like temporary 2, 3 days. I don't even think it's more than a week in most cases. And then they moved them to like a more permanent placement with somebody who's a regular foster care parent. But long story short, often a relative placement was preferable, but finding the relatives, identifying the relatives, seeing if the relatives wanted to take the children, and seeing whether or not the relatives could take the children took a minute. Like, I mean, in all fairness, like there's a lot of things at the system that I don't think were right or fair. There's a lot of things with the system I don't think were right or fair. Okay. There are a lot of things with the system that I don't think were right or fair. But I will agree that taking some time to find a relative who was willing to take the children was something that was a positive thing. Because if you could be with your aunt or whomever, it would keep you in the family system. In some cases, made the visitation of the parents, depending on the parents' situation and reason for the kids being taken, easier. And it wasn't such a foreign placement. So at this point, they're looking for a relative. And in this case, and this actually happened often with single moms, in this case, the father is being chosen for a relative placement. Fathers, if the parents were not together, fathers were often considered. There are a whole lot of various situations, obviously, with what they were doing, but notifying them was often difficult. And finding out whether or not they take them. But in this case, they find out that Keith is available, unfortunately, like not in the greatest way. Like at this point, he's being served because, okay, so the mother's parental rights are affected, but also the father's parental rights are affected. And in this case, since they were married, it makes it easy because there's a presumption that he is the father under the law. So the issue is notifying him. Now, notification. Service and notification are their own bailiwick. And in this case, the sheriff is notifying you. So, like, the sheriff is like this vestige of like English common law. They have a lot of purposes. One is like service of papers. One is like evictions, some is like law enforcement, but they have like a lot of like ancillary things. And in Cuyahoga County, the sheriff did service, like service process serve was a process server, and was the main process server, which actually, to be honest, much better than California, where you have like a whole like process servers industry. Like people will take shit from the sheriff, whereas they might ignore like Joe who showed up in his car with some papers. Which is often why it's portrayed on TV that you've been served like as a dupe because people will avoid service. People generally don't avoid the sheriff because it's the guy with the gun and like they don't mess around like that. Miss it, moving on. So The sheriff has showed up at his aunt's house. So the thing about Keith is that he's not itinerant, but he's one of these guys. Actually, I know quite a few people this, and maybe this is like an East Coast quality. Like they don't change their address. So their address is always like their parents' house or their aunt's house or something. And they like actually like live somewhere else, but they like or they move like every couple of years, but they don't change their permanent address from like their like some relative's house. Never understood like why you just not would have your own address, but I know a lot of people do it. I don't have a why. Like I just don't have a why. Maybe because there was subletting in New York City. Like I have so many questions. I don't know. My address is my address. All that said, Keith's address is his aunt's house. And since that's his like permanent address, as far as the government is concerned, she's the one who served with these papers about the foster care and Olivia being removed. So Cora calls him and she's like, "The sheriff came here with some papers." And look, the sheriff's never, but as far as like eviction goes in law enforcement, the sheriff showing up is never like a positive thing. Like the sheriff has come to see you. So she's like, "Come over here and get these papers." So he gets the papers, and the highlight is so he keeps like Sheila's number in the back of his wallet, and he's sort of regretting not trying harder to keep in touch with Olivia. So the highlight is I dial the number I kept in the back of my wallet, wishing I tried harder to get in contact with Olivia. I listened to the phone ring, wonder if Sheila would even pick up. Sheila's home number had been unlisted for years. Seeing the folks from her old neighborhood when she visited there was one thing, but getting phone calls from wayward relatives who wanted money because they thought she and all lawyers were rich, or free legal advice because that's what family was for favors like fixing parking tickets, because they didn't know the difference between a lawyer and a court clerk had been trying on her nerves. I knew the guy tried backwards and forwards, but Olivia always kept Auntie Cora apprised of their phone number. Today was not a day for social niceties. Sheila, what in the hell is going on over there? I just got some papers from Auntie Cora's house talking about Olivia being in foster care. Good evening, Keith, Sheila said. It's so nice to hear your voice. You haven't seen your daughter in what, 3 or 4 years? Do you have a job yet? Cut the bull acting like your shit don't stink. How in the hell did Olivia end up in foster care? I didn't wait for an answer. Are you planning to get her back or drink yourself into oblivion? How dare you? Who in the hell gave you the right to pass judgment? Didn't want to leave your mama's house? Didn't want to keep a job? That's when I left your lazy ass. Didn't step up and do the manly thing and take care of your daughter. Don't start talking to me about raising a child. You aren't here day in and day out to deal with the everyday stresses. Is she fitting in? Does she have enough friends? Is she eating too much junk food? What to tell her when she cries that her dear dad doesn't love her? So don't come in here like your father of the year, Sheila said. So unfortunately, how can I say this? Unfortunately, and this is the note, all the unresolved issues come up here during this conversation during a heightened time. It's one of those things they talk about when they talk about like couples counseling and the reason that couples argue. And often all the crap that people like the resentments and all that bubbles up during an argument. So they're not even arguing about what they're arguing about. They're arguing about all the past crap that hasn't been resolved. And that happens here. But Keith's really sort of having none of it. And he says, "Are you drinking?" And she says, "Hell yes, I'm drinking. I need a little rest and relaxation in the day, maybe a cocktail or nightcap, but I'm no drunk. This whole mess in juvenile court is a mistake. You know, they don't like to see black people make it in Cleveland." So she's like, sort of like put deflecting using this, I don't call it conspiracy theory because it's true, but using the idea that black people getting ahead is an anathema to the society in which we live. And that is actually like indeed true, but she's also really truly like not doing the best thing here. And he says, "I couldn't fault her logic. The daily newspaper was filled with black leaders taken down by extramarital affairs and unpaid taxes. Look what the FBI tried to do to Martin Luther King." "What happened?" I ask, conciliation in my tone. Sheila's voice lost its impatience. Olivia's guidance counselor got a little overzealous. She's one of those young white girls out of school, you know the type, gonna save black folks from themselves. I did know the type. I'd met them sh when Sheila had been in college and in law school. I'd have preferred a life without those people, but Sheila had sought it out, and this was the result. Oh, this is like all the issues. Like, this is like all the issues, like, bubbled up in a paragraph. Because, like, how do I want to save this? Okay, so like the white savior type on one hand, and like there's a bunch of movies about that. Like the young white person's gonna go into the inner city school, whatever, like it is, and save the black people. That's like one whole like trope. Then like the next trope is about like people being taken down, and the FBI or the CIA or all the conspiracies, some of which are true about how black leaders get taken down for like minor things. A recent example is, oh my God, which woman is this? The one who was recently indicted for mortgage fraud for like buying a house using a mortgage. So most primary mortgages assume you're going to occupy the home, because if you buy a house and you don't plan to occupy it, the mortgage rate is actually higher. This I know from rental property. That said, people will buy a house that they do plan to rent out using a mortgage that they are going to do just to save on the mortgage rate. It doesn't mean they're going to default on the mortgage or whatever. So whichever prosecutor, I think was in wrapped up in Donald Trump, had done that. She bought some house for her niece, I don't know, some other relative, and that is considered mortgage fraud. It is a popular kind of mortgage fraud, and there's some deep irony in being, how can I say this, pursued by a president who indeed is subject to his own felony convictions for fraud, among other things. Okay, so all that said, it is known to happen to people in the black community that they're pursued for things that white people otherwise get away with. And I'm not saying fraud is great, but a lot of people engage in like low level minor fraud, and some people get away with it and some people don't. So, all of that. And then there's like the third issue of some black people I have met live a life that doesn't engage in that broader world, whether it's corporate or whatever, any of those environments where they're unlikely to encounter people who don't treat them well. So this is like the trifecta of like black community tropes, you know, trying to get ahead and being pushed down, being accused or convicted of things that otherwise white people would get away with, and being too big for your britches, and therefore this is the result. And it's sort of not fair, because the whole meritocracy, seek out education argument in America encourages people to go forward, but that doesn't mean you're going to be treated as well. And that's just, oh, it's just one of those things. It's just one of those things. Anyway, so in chapter 36, hold on. It's an Olivia chapter. And it's actually, this is so interesting. It's about the visit from the social worker. And when I worked as a guardian, I think I sometimes would visit at the same time as a social worker, just to like minimize the disruption in a child's life with like adults they don't know sort of coming in. But what that gave me is an opportunity to see what a quote unquote social worker visit is. Because I think, so one of the issues that comes up when we talk about foster care, especially when something happens to children, is that because social workers are overburdened in this system, underpaid, overburdened, have a huge caseload often, they're understaffed. We could go on. Whenever something happens, one of the biggest blame is like leveled on social workers because they don't have enough visits, they lie about their visits, whatever that is. Like that trope is like well played out, especially like in movies or on TV or any of like cop shows that deal with those sorts of issues. That said, when I would go to the visits with a social worker, what I did find is sometimes, and I didn't go on a ton of these, so I can't like speak as like And obviously, this was not my job. So these are people who are driving around all day in their own cars. I mean, they get reimbursed, but you know, it is what it is. Visiting children. And I found the visits kind of cursory. So often the foster parents, and as I mentioned before, who are being paid for the privilege where they wouldn't pay the parents for this, often, I don't want to say like dress the kids up, but made sure the kids were clean, their hair was done, like all of that to give this perception that they were doing the most. They were doing the most. And the social workers who had a relationship with the foster parents, often because they would place like subsequent children there, so they had like a different kind of relationship with the foster parents, even though their goal was to like advocate for children. I think it's a conflict of interest, probably. Often had this relationship. So when the foster parent like trotted out like world's best behaved child, then they could indeed like buy into the show. So in this case, Linda, who's Olivia's foster worker, is like, do your hair, like make sure your hair is done, make sure like your clothes are done. And she trots out Olivia, who looks well put together and well cared for. And the social worker doesn't aim to talk to Olivia alone. She sort of is like, okay, you look good, whatever. And then she goes outside, I believe, and talks to the social worker, but it doesn't delve. So Olivia now has this like awful thing that happened to her. And I think he was even thinking about talking about it, but there's really no opportunity because it was more of a dog and pony show and less of like a true assessment of how the child is being cared for in foster care. So let's go to chapter 37. So chapter 37, we're back to the my Philip Margolin, thing where it's called the confirmation. So she's out down there, like in the offices, doing like the handshaking with this thing. And one of the senators says, oh, I'm so sorry to hear about your troubles. And it's a very like old boy sort of focused environment. And Sheila's anything but a good old boy. And they make it sound like the likelihood that she is going to be confirmed is up in the air. And like Sheila's got a lot going on, and her inability to like juggle all of it successfully while also having like a habit is deeply problematic. I don't know if when I wrote it, I wanted you to be sympathetic toward her, to understand her fight, or to put her feet to the fire. Maybe all three. Personally, I don't have a lot of warm feelings towards Sheila, but I know writing an unsympathetic heroine is not the best. So we get to chapter 38, and I think that'll be the last chapter because we're getting on in time. It's called Doth Protest Too Much. And so Sheila is now going to meet with her own, the guardian ad litem, Sheila's, excuse me, Olivia's guardian ad litem, but the guardian ad litem in Sheila's case. And it's a woman named Sherry Otis who has her own thoughts. Everybody has their own thoughts, feelings, and actions, and she's a little worried about how this is gonna go. So the guardian is there, and she says, I trudge up the stairs because like they live on the second floor in this two-family house they live in. I trudged up the stairs, rubbing my face with my hands. It was overwhelming trying to convince well-meaning folks in the Cuyahoga County Justice Juvenile System that I could do what I'd already done for years, raise my daughter. And that's sort of the standard. Like people come, and I mean, I don't know if I did this as a guardian, I'd have to really like do some self-examination there. But I'd watch parents try to convince me that they could do what we expect parents to do, which is raise their child. And in the cases where it was about poverty, I was not doubting their issue to raise their child at all. I was there to just do the thing that I was like statutorily obligated to do, which is like do an assessment and make a report. But it was sort of sad in a way because, okay, if you adopt a child, there's like home studies, there's all these things you have to do and all these like hurdles you have to jump to adopt a child. But if you just want to have a baby, you can just have a baby. But at some point in this like system, sometimes parents, mostly mothers, have to try to could then convince people that they're able to raise their children. And it's one of the sort of the saddest things to ever witness, to watch people do something that they'd already done, whether they'd done it well, whether they'd done it flawlessly, probably not. But I don't know if any of us can be or should be held to that standard. I think the standard is, are you doing it good enough? And Sheila feels like the double burden of having to try to convince people that she's doing what she had done all along.
By the way, Judged, the book I'm talking about is free on every book platform. Grab it wherever you read.